Good afternoon. Welcome to the Healthy Aging Show. I'm Dennis Batuas.
I'm Dawn Del Greco.
And John is out playing with some game that they're offering $1 million for the 15th caller. But this is tape, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, no technician today for us.
We are going to be talking about issues about getting older, intelligent aging, lessons for life. And we are brought to you by Comfort Keepers nationwide, locally in Lower Fairfield County. We help people stay safe and independent in their own home. And we have many clients that say, I want to stay in my own home, and we help them do it. You can reach us at 203-629-5029, and we provide non-medical in-home care. How often have you been in a hospital or any type of operating room?
Me?
You.
Me. I have been 3 times.
Okay. I've been 5.
Well, you're fortunately,
they're all for repairing things that I broke. But in each case, in each of my cases, I had to be put to sleep. Anesthesiologist administered it. And, you know, I don't think that I gave a second thought to it.
No, not at all.
Well, we're going to give first thought to it today because we have with us an anesthesiologist from Stanford Anesthesia Associates, Dr. Betty Ann Robustelli. And she is from the practice, which is in Stanford. And you are under contract with Stanford Hospital.
Yes, we are.
So you are the people. You are the group that puts everybody under.
Yes.
All right.
And they bring them right back out again.
Well,
most important.
That's a good thing. The more we talked about this in preparation, and this has been Dawn's pet for the longest time, and it was evidenced by all of the research that she did in preparation. But it's an underknown
mm-hmm.
practice, procedure, and is it fair to say that people don't give a second thought to this?
Some people do. Some people are very frightened about the anesthesia. But then there are other people that really, like you said, they don't really even think about it. They just say, put me to sleep and wake me up when it's over.
Well, you know who your doctor that's performing the procedure is.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But how often does someone make it a point to find out who the doctor is that's helping or making it able for the doctor to do the procedure.
Do you find that perhaps the longer the surgery, the indication, if it's something like an open heart surgery versus joint replacement or other types of surgeries, is any one group more prone to check into their anesthesiologist?
I think parents with young children, that's mm-hmm. one of the groups that really looks into who's taking care of their child. But not overall, I really think that there's sort of lack of understanding or awareness about what is going on in the operating room, and they just assume that.
And in some ways, or in some instances, your role is more critical than the surgeon's, because if not administered properly, the damages could be devastating, and the operation may be minor.
Right. I mean, that's a lot of the times what does happen.
Right.
Or if the surgeon gets into trouble, we're the one that really has to be their backup.
Step in and close the breach.
Right.
I think we assume so readily that we're in safe hands and don't give it a second thought when we look at what the history with anesthesia has been. You know, all of us have seen the Western where pliers come out.
It's progressively gotten safer and safer and safer.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the statistics that I saw, the amount or number per thousands or millions of procedures where there was problems just decreased dramatically over the last 20 years.
That's true. I think the medications are much more safe now. There's a lot more research about the medications, and also the monitoring potential that we have, where years ago they just didn't have the sophisticated monitoring that we can do now. We could monitor about if the patient's awake by looking at their EEG, and all their vital signs can be monitored non-invasively or with, you know, invasive monitors.
Mm-hmm.
And it really makes anesthesia much more safe now than it was before.
Well, the fact that we've had so much research that has developed medications and procedures, it only goes to logic that we would have the same level of research into ways of alleviating pain and making that process of anesthesia and its administration that much more safer.
Now, when you're looking at how the drugs have come along, we're still using opiates, is that right?
Yes.
And looking back, historically speaking, cocaine, I guess, I don't know what the proper word with the opiates were that were, you know, the prerequisites of what we have now and what we're using and how they've been modified and improved.
Right.
intravenous or how
is that? Yeah, there's intravenous opioids or narcotics, and there's oral versions of them. You know, it's a big class of drugs that are used really across the board that still have a huge amount of side effects associated with them. That, unfortunately, has not changed. But, you know, dosing has been really looked into a lot. And then there's other modes of pain management that, in combination with the opioids, have then decreased the side effects by using a combination of drugs. So they are still the mainstay for pain management.
Is there a definition of anesthesia? Because we know that it is used to suppress pain.
Yes.
But it's also to suppress memory. And does it also paralyze?
Yeah, and in certain instances, yes, paralysis is needed. There's really a wide range of anesthetics, if you'd like to call them. You know, we can anesthetize just one part of the body that's being operated on, and you can be wide awake. Some surgeries are not amenable to that, where they need to be totally unconscious, and that we've taken over the respirations for them, so they're intubated on a ventilator and paralyzed. So there's a wide range, and it really certain procedures are amenable to certain anesthetic. And we try and use whichever technique will have the least side effects, especially with the elderly and with the newborn and the young children. That's really kind of the age groups that are very sensitive.
Well, dosing, as in any other kind of medication for those age groups, is dramatically different than for a normal mature adult.
Right. You know, with pediatrics, it's a per kilo dosing scale. The trouble is with the elderly population, just because there isn't the magic number that you reduce a dose for the elderly. It's really, you know, you have to look at their comorbid conditions and their sort of overall health to be able to say, okay, this person's not going to really tolerate what someone else that's the same age would tolerate. But there's no, you know, in pediatrics, it's much more of a formula. But with the elderly, there's not that formula that we can use.
Health, lifestyle, their metabolism,
everything's
got to come into play.
Yes.
And that definitely, when you're starting with an infant, they're kind of coming from the same baseline.
Yes.
Whereas now you've got a group of people that have got 70 or 80 years of mixed good and bad history.
Usage.
Go back to the car.
A lot of
miles on that
again.
Body.
Now, how does a team, as a patient, when a patient is scheduled to come in for a procedure, how do you and everyone else in that operating room, how does that team function? How do you plan what's going to happen as far as the type of anesthesia?
What's happening in the background?
The pre-planning, yeah. What's the behind the stage here? Well, now we'll go to theater with behind the stage.
Right. There's a lot of pre-planning in actually the OR, for the nurses, for whatever instruments they need to do. So the room is really all prepared according to what the surgeon has told them and how they're going to approach, as opposed to, you know, if they can do it laparoscopically or an open procedure. So there's a lot of things that the surgeon will communicate to the nursing staff that's in the room. And then we meet the patients really just before they're going to go into the operating room. We do see most of the charts, hopefully about a week before. We don't meet the patients, but we see their history and, again, their medical conditions and anything that is kind of a red flag to us that we can investigate and get all the information. They need to get a cardiac evaluation beforehand, pulmonary evaluation. Hopefully we have all that information approximately a week beforehand to be able to do that. But then we don't really meet the patients until a few minutes before. And again, based on their medical conditions and the surgical procedure, we decide on what the anesthetic would be best for that patient. And, you know, we have a discussion with them. Certain people, you know, are not amenable to certain anesthetics. So, you know, you have the discussion because they really kind of make the final decision. And that's where the planning side of starts. And then that's conveyed to the nursing staff that's in the operating room, as well as the surgeon. And we just work as a team once the patient's in the OR.
You bring up a good point, too. I hadn't thought about this, but we did not have as many tests previously before surgeries as we do now. And I think we've
become, ferret out what conditions you might be dealing with. Because and that probably reveals things that you may know from the history of the patient or that they haven't told you.
Yes.
Or the patient may not know either.
Well, and that's true. But how important is full disclosure by the patient to the doctor or the staff?
Right. I mean, that's very important. And a lot of, in the pre-op evaluation, we have found many illnesses that were unknown to the patient. I've had a couple cases where they've had just pre-op EKGs that were abnormal, and then they ended up going for, you know, cardiac catheterizations and angioplasties and stent. Just pre-op, I mean, with no history or, you know, really unknown to the patient, or we've made lung cancer diagnoses because they have chest x-rays pre-op, just as a routine screening tool. and diagnose these things pre-op. So the screening tools are really important. And also, like you're saying, the disclosure. You just need to, you know, tell us about your illicit habits. Like I said, we're not there to judge. We just need to know because of the interactions with a lot of our medications can really be, you know, detrimental. So the important thing is just to really be forthcoming and really come with a list of your medications. A lot of patients have no idea. They'll say to me, it's the little white pill. You know, and it's really, you know, it's really very important. And I always tell them just, you know, keep a list in your wallet.
Could they bring the meds in with them?
Yes.
Just so that you could take a look at them.
A lot of times they'll come in with all their bottles, and that's fine too. And or just a list of their medications, because really a lot of people don't know that, and it makes it very difficult to try and backpedal, call people at home to get the meds that they're on. And like I said, to medication, when they last ate or drank is another huge problem that we find. That, you know, there's a certain amount of hours that you have to abstain from eating and drinking for safety reasons, and patients think you're just being difficult, and they don't follow those directions, and then it really can lead to catastrophic events.
Well, like so many people take aspirin for therapeutic purposes, and that's only going to accelerate bleeding.
Yes.
So they have to stop it so many days
in advance.
But there's the herbal supplements as well that we don't even think about those bottles.
Well, exactly. And that's something that we keep on driving home, that when you are talking to any of your doctors, letting them know all of these things, because the interaction, not just for surgical purposes, just for basic interaction with drugs that they may prescribe.
Right. A lot of the homeopathic medications that people are on now are just really important to divulge. I mean, with the ginger and the garlic, and there's a lot of things that really interfere.
Garlic?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know about garlic.
Yeah, garlic is...
What does garlic do?
It causes bleeding.
Really?
They make you stop any garlic supplements.
They're going to my
surgery.
Entire cuisine. I'll be to eat for a week before that.
I'm not sure that garlic...
You have to eat huge amounts of garlic.
It's when you take it as a supplement.
Well, here's ginger. I mean, that's another.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think eating it, the quantity that you would have to eat is.
What you have with your sushi and what you have with other foods is, you know, don't worry about that.
I can tell she had garlic before she got here.
Well, that's why they wear masks.
That's right. Absolutely. Now, how do we shop as the patient for a good anesthesiologist? What should we look for to know that we're getting quality care?
It is difficult because...
Do you have a choice?
Right. I mean, you do have a choice among anesthesiologists within the group.
Right.
And word of mouth is a big thing that you can either ask your surgeon or really ask someone in your family
or
friends.
So someone says, I want the tall guy with the mask?
Yes.
Most of them are when you're laying down.
I know. Well, these people are working in the background, and it's not that you folks are the stars that the surgeons are. So how do you get... And you don't want to get well-known by notoriety in the newspaper, so you want word of mouth that they did a good job, but doing a good job almost brings you no recognition.
Right. I mean, that's, you know...
It's a catch-22.
It is. But, I mean, most people do. I think people that have had multiple surgical experiences, they will find that, okay, this was a much better experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I find. And they'll ask you who you are. They try to give all the patients, there's actually a card that they're all given, that everyone that took part in their care, from who greeted them when they came into the hospital, the surgical scrub techs in the OR, everyone who they came in contact with, including us, just so you know who took care of you. So it's an interesting... you know, concept, because there are a lot of people in the background that, you know, everything went fine because all these people took care of you.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's, you know, just the information is getting out there more.
Right.
But really, I mean, you can look on, you can web, you know, go onto the internet now and do, you know, search on us just like any other doctor, see where we were trained. We could look at our malpractice history. You know, all that's there.
There's a lot of disclosure out there. We're going to jump to a break, but we're talking with Dr. Betty Ann Robustelli from Stanford Anesthesia Associates, and we will be right back. Stay tuned. Stay awake. Welcome back. You're listening to the Healthy Aging Show, and we are talking with Dr. Betty Ann Robustelli from Stanford Anesthesia Associates, and we're talking about those people that put you to sleep and bring you back after a marvelous operation.
I have a question regarding the types, because in my research, we have general, regional, and local. So
sounds like a train.
Sounds like the Northeast. So what does this mean in layman English?
General anesthesia is when you're totally asleep and unconscious.
That's John most of the time.
That's actually me when I'm asleep at night.
And we really take over a lot of your bodily functions. You're on a respirator. We're breathing for you.
They won't take over your brain.
Right.
Don't worry.
Right.
You know, even though I think you left it there sometimes.
But you were really...
Kidding. I'm kidding.
No, but we had this discussion yesterday. We'll come back to that.
Did you?
Of anesthesia of old.
Okay.
Yeah, really. It's a good story. Anyway, so you take over our breathing at that point.
Right. So it's really just a totally unconscious state that you will have no awareness of the operative time. So that's really what general anesthesia is. Regional anesthesia is where the part of the body that is being operated on is anesthetized. So if you're having surgery on your leg will be anesthetized, or your arm. So certain surgeries are amenable to that and certain are not. And then local anesthesia is really sort of when you go to the dentist's office. That's the best example. Or they'll do small procedures where the surgeon is really working alone. There's usually not an anesthesiologist there. And they inject local anesthesia where they're working because it's usually something small that doesn't really need any systemic medication to make you relaxed or be asleep.
If you're getting stitches in the emergency
room.
Right,
that's considered local.
Which I've had experience with that.
Yeah, you've been a repeat offender down in Greenwich. They know you on a first name basis. All right, but still that Novocaine local at the dentist office. See, I get gas when I go to the dentist office because I'm a pain. So I'm a very large chicken.
Okay, now I understand what you're saying.
No, I know. They have to give me the, I know. If you edit that out so it doesn't sound bad, they give me whatever that happy gas stuff is.
The laughing gas.
Yeah, they have the I don't care gas. It's like, okay, fine. I'm really afraid of the dentist. I'm sorry.
Well, he's afraid of you too.
I'm sure he is.
You know, everybody has their favorite doctors, and I'm sure the doctors have their favorite patients.
Right.
But with the general, there's certain ways that you layer us through that, right? As far as the, are there different applications as far as to relax us and before we get completely out? Is there, what's the mixture that makes that
there's
happen?
Different stages of the anesthetic. Initially, there'll be an anxiolytic will be given to really kind of just reduce the anxiety and to help people just be a little more calm. Sometimes we'll do that before they come into the operating room. If it's very frightening for someone to come into the operating room. Or some people are okay with that, and we start that once they're in the operating room. That's usually given intravenously. And then all their monitors are put on. We'll also give anti-nausea medicines because nausea and vomiting is a big problem with anesthesia. And then we will slowly induce the general anesthetic. Propofol's gotten the big notoriety with Michael Jackson, but that's a very big anesthetic drug that we use all the time to really put you to sleep.
Administered in the right setting by
the right
people.
Yes, it's a very safe drug if it's done like that.
Right.
With full disclosure.
Most things are.
Right. And then the operative procedure will begin. And you're monitored the whole time. There's anesthesiologists with you for every minute that you're in the operating room. And you do have to make all different types of adjustments. You're usually kept asleep with the inhalational gases. Pain medication is given throughout the procedure.
Oh.
Because there's various stimuli of when they start to operate and when they near the end and the metabolism of the drugs, depending on how long the surgery is. So there's medication given throughout the procedure. And there's also medication given to really, some people don't tolerate the anesthesia. Their blood pressure is an issue. If they have diabetes, monitoring their sugar, various things to increase the work of their heart. So there's a lot of things that go on that you sort of to keep that person kind of in a neutral playing field.
Okay.
So that's really kind of what goes on. And then when the surgical procedure is finished, the anesthesia is slowly withdrawn and the body metabolizes it. And then you will wake up when the body has metabolized the drugs.
Now, in addition to letting you know about the drugs that we've been taking as far as prescriptions and things, nutrition-wise and hydration and things like that, are there things that the patient would do prior to a surgery to accommodate what's going to be happening with their body? We know some drugs you're not supposed to take, but should we perhaps stop smoking? Should we make sure that we are well hydrated, get rest? I mean, are there some...
You know, smoking's always...
I've read smoking is an issue. Why is smoking an issue?
Because you're at much higher risk for infections, because it really affects the whole immune system. And so you're much higher risk for infection, especially pulmonary complications. I mean, their lungs are really damaged with any degree of smoking, and their risk for pneumonia is so much higher after any anesthetic. And even their wound healing, the nicotine is really bad for the blood supply to an area. It reduces the blood flow, so and that's very important for wound healing. So even nicotine patches are not great either, because again, it's still giving the nicotine to the body that vasoconstricts the blood vessels that are needed to help with wound healing. So, and you know, it's really, I mean, it's it's great if you can stop 2 weeks before, at least.
You know, when I read that, if you can stop 2 weeks before surgery, and why can't you stop? I mean, that should be
right,
it. Because
right.
As a non-smoker, or as a former smoker, and you are a former smoker.
You got to tell everyone that as well.
Well, if I didn't, you would. But going through those first several weeks are the most traumatic, and your body changes the most dramatically during that while it's purging itself of all that junk. And if you can do that, then you should be off the stuff forever. But the long-term effects of what you've just described don't go away a week before surgery.
Right. I mean, not the effect on the lungs per se. I mean, the damage that's been done, you know, leading to emphysema and things like that do not reverse. But really, even just abstaining from a week to have the nicotine out of the system is very helpful. And it really does, they say, will reduce the risk of pneumonia by even just stopping a week to 2 weeks beforehand. The body really does start to regenerate relatively quickly. Very helpful.
All the more reason to stop smoking.
Right. That's encouraging. I did also read that if you actually engage your team and let them know that you want to quit smoking while you're in the hospital, that having been through a procedure, once again, you're quite clean and you don't have any residue in your body. It's a nice way to launch out. So that's one time that if you're in for a few days with the hospital that you have a really a good base to begin.
That's an interesting approach.
I thought so too.
Because you can't smoke in the hospital. So you
can't smoke any place.
Right.
I mean, so give it up.
Well, I am opinionated, but I do not like it around. I don't like when I'm approaching a hospital environment and people are smoking.
Okay, we're going to take another break because I think it's time. We will be right back. We're talking with Dr. Betty Ann Robustelli about anesthesia. Be right back.